This coverage of the Global Conversation on Change is brought to you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes. For more years than I care to remember, before dawn on Tuesday at Davos Week, my bundled up body trudged through the ice and snow to guarantee a decent seat for the unveiling of the latest Elements Trust Barometer. Temperature-wise, 7 a.m. in Davos in January is practically the middle of the night. But this is one sacrifice happily made. For me, the event was always the highlight of the week. And I'm not alone in that assessment.
I'm so glad to be here. I think this is the best event in Davos. I've been attending the whole Davos like 11 times, so congratulations, Richard.
That was Yoshito Hori, founder and president of Japan's Globus University, speaking at this morning's launch of the 2020 edition. We'll hear more from him later. The man he referred to is Richard Edelman, chief executive of the company which bears his name and host for the 20th time of the Gold Standard in analyzing how much ordinary folk trust around the world or distrust their governments, business, the media and NGOs. The report consolidates results from 34,000 respondents in 28 countries. Kenya was added this year, or around 1,150 in each market. South Africa has been included in the barometer for some years. It's fared poorly in recent times, ranking worst for trust in government, a position it fell into during the Zuma era and continues to occupy. That score drags down the country's overall ranking to a net 44% trust, with South Africans among the 15 nations whose mass population on average just don't trust the system. It scores slightly less than the US at 45%, but is ahead of Ireland, France, Japan, Spain, and, of course, the bottom two, the UK at 39% and Russia at just 27% of the population trusting the system. As we'll hear later, mass distrust is reflective of a system in transition. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Here's this morning's introduction from the esteemed Mr. Edelman.
Trust has changed. And changed profoundly. The basic premise for trust was established by Francis Fukuyama in the early 90s after the fall of the Soviet Union. And he wrote in his book at the end of history that in fact it was a strong social construct, an excellent legal system, and upward mobility that would generate trust in society. That compact is now broken.
Edelman opined to Davos's early rises that growing distrust is the consequence of seismic events of the past two decades. The Bush-Blair weapons of mass destruction lies, which were used to justify the Iraq War, skewed benefits of globalization, the Great Recession, the rise of India and China, mushrooming of disinformation, aka fake news, through social media. But the major driver is income inequality and everything that flows from it.
The mass class divide started in the US, the UK, and France, leading to electoral upheavals in each of those countries. What's happened now is it's transversal. Appreciate the extent of the mass class divide is in Happy Canada, 21 points. Germany, 20 points. Saudi Arabia, 20 points. This we've never seen before. Now double digits in India, in China, etc. It is premised now on income inequality. So we've established that the mass class divide is profound. We've established that it's record number of countries and record levels. But we have to understand why. And the why is that fears are eclipsing hopes. This trust paradox, this idea of rising boats, everybody should be happy, people are foreshadowing what's going to happen in the next decade. And they're foreshadowing it on the basis that they're afraid of losing their jobs. 83% told us, I think I'm going to lose my jobs because of gig economy, because of automation, and because of outsourcing. When that kind of soul-wrenching fear gets into you, you don't lose it. And you don't lose it also, it spreads beyond. In every developed country that we studied this year, every developed country, more people believe that their incomes will decline in the next 5 years than increase.
Which brings us to what for me was a welcome surprise. South Africa has been long castigated as having the world's worst Gini coefficient, i.e. income inequality. It actually scores pretty well in the real world, according to this survey. The difference between the way South African graduates, high earners, and media junkies see things, that's the group that Elements terms the informed public, is pretty close to how the rest of its society views the world. South Africa's score on this great division between the elites and the rest is a third of the level of the UK's and one-fifth of Australia's. But even more encouraging, the Edelman's Trust Barometer shows South Africa was one of only two countries surveyed where its citizens' economic optimism actually improved in the past year. A healthy 57% of South Africans now believe that they will be better off in 5 years' time. For context, only 15% of Japanese feel the same, 19% French, 27% British, and 32% of Australians.
Three quarters of people tell us that they don't believe in the media. They think that the media is compromised by fake news. And actually, it's most acute in the U.S. and in the U.K. So the media plays a very big role in all of this. The perception of chasing clicks and chasing economics, bad.
South Africans share this perception of the news providers. Only 40% of us trust the media. But that's double those who trust the government, an area where the country continues to prop up the global table with an appalling 20% approval rating this year. And we're at the bottom by miles. Spain comes second last at 30%, with even Donald Trump's America at 39%. Citizens of China, where 90% trust their government, and India at 81% seem to live in a different universe. South Africa's business and NGO sectors score considerably better, though. Both are in the upper half of the global table, with their trust levels at 58% and 59% respectively. Here's Richard Edelman again.
The big fact that I want you to appreciate is 75% tell us the system doesn't work. It's unfair. Unfair. And 56% said capitalism as it is currently conceived is a force for bad in the world. And this is across all the democracies, all of them. 70% in France. Capitalism doesn't work.
His key phrase, capitalism as it is currently perceived. The trend bucker on this score is Japan, where despite a poor economic performance and weak prospects, a healthy 65% of its citizens, it's about two-thirds, believe that capitalism is actually a force for good. That's the cue, once more, for Professor Hori.
And I've been analyzing this like a survey for 11 years, and I'm finding out that people don't believe in capitalism. And Richard said that. And return is only followed by investors. And Klaus Schwab came up with the concept of stakeholder capitalism this year. However, he said that he found out about stakeholder capitalism in Japan 25 years ago. He was inspired about that. But in Japan, we live in stakeholder capitalism. And the survey says that Japan, you know, people in Japan is least afraid, least feared in terms of pride and dignity. Because the society itself is run based on the capitalism, based on stakeholder capitalism with trust. What it's saying in this survey is interesting is that three times more people believe in ethics, like integrity and also about purpose and dependability. And only one quarter is about competent. Competent is the ability to make return. Ethics is totally different. This is the value. So what we all have to do as leaders is talk about vision, mission, and value. And that should be the core of stakeholder capitalism. Return will come afterward. And stakeholder capitalism is the belief that customers, employees have to be happy. And then at the same time, suppliers have to be happy. Society have to be happy. And the conclusion is that the shareholders will get return. So it's the other way around. Like in case of, you know, capitalism, return will come to shareholders.
But you're saying that Japan has lived through this, but has got a system that people should actually be looking to as a way to manage through this, where you actually have long looked at the various stakeholders rather than just shareholder returns.
There's no people who have been left behind in like a rural area.
Okay.
So we don't have a mass like a division that Richard mentioned in Japan, because people, companies are not firing people. They feel that employees are the assets, and they retrain them in the company. Whenever you have automation or AI come in, they have been replaced and re-retrained, and they have been, you know, reshifted to different locations. And therefore, that kind of stakeholder capitalism is where I think you should look at Japan about the future of capitalism.
As Professor Hori noted, something the Japanese have been at for a quarter of a century is finally being recognized elsewhere, not least by the World Economic Forum chairman, Klaus Schwab. And where the WEF goes, the rest of the world tends to follow. The concept of embracing stakeholder capitalism makes a lot of sense to me, as did the rational perspective of another member of the high-powered panel this morning. That's Microsoft's president, Brad Smith. Have a listen.
You know, we're not necessarily living through unprecedented times. If you look at each major period historically of rapid and massive technological change, it tends both to, you know, exacerbate income inequality, and it especially saps confidence in people who worry that they don't have the skills to be successful in the next era. And, you know, historically, these things get to a point where ultimately democracy is correct. You tend to see the rise of populism. That's usually the indicator that, you know, a political correction is coming. And, you know, you look at, to me, one of the most interesting days in American history was the 14th of September, 1901. What happened that day? William McKinley died. Theodore Roosevelt became the president. The Gilded Age ended. The Progressive Era began. And you know, you sense this around the world. You know, will we shift in a manner that fundamentally addresses some of these broad concerns? Will, as Richard said, businesses invest more in lifting the tide of everybody who works for them? And, you know, I think that there'll probably be some day or days in the course of this coming decades when we'll see some historical similarities. But I do think that we have this other challenge in the 21st century that we didn't have in the 20th. One is, I think democracy is less agile. It goes to the point that you know, Jimmy made, you know, whether it's gerrymandering or money in politics. You know, you could argue that the democracy is less responsive to people than it was in the past. And second, democracy is under attack from the outside, fundamentally with the weaponization of technology by certain authoritarian governments who are clearly using it to attack politicians and spread disinformation. And then fundamentally you have the fourth estate, this great pillar of democracy, journalism, that has been weakened. And, you know, it has been weakened by technology as well. You know, we've seen the complete evisceration of classified ads, and so people are chasing clicks to try to make up for it. So, you know, you see the pieces that are going to have to be addressed over the course of this decade, I think, to restore health in democracy, which does require a certain level of confidence in capitalism.
Just go back to you quickly. I mean, you talked about a big political event in 1901. What should companies be doing? Richard made the point that people trust companies to be effective, and obviously, you know, companies have huge amounts of power in the economy now. What should they be doing unilaterally without relying on governments? And you, as Microsoft, you know, one of the biggest companies in the world, what's the onus on you guys now?
I think, first of all, I think that the BRT's statement is the right approach. I mean, I would argue that we've been following that approach as a company for, you know, 7 or 8 years, and thinking about not just our profits for our shareholders, but the needs of our customers, the needs of our employees, and the needs of the communities in which we work. I think we should be making investments that are more broad-minded, and we have. You know, we put $750 million into affordable housing in the region where we have our headquarters in Seattle. Last week we announced we'd put $1 billion into a climate innovation fund to really try to accelerate the technology needed for carbon removal. We should do what we can, but will democracy be saved by people who are not elected by the public? I doubt it. You know, the world's democracies need to be led by the people the public elects, and the rest of us need to do our part. But if this were a movie, I would argue we are aspiring to get the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, not the leading actor in the play or the movie. We all need to do more, but you know, democracy and confidence in it, I think, must be restored first and foremost by the people the public elects. Okay.
Well said, Brad. So there you have it. Two clear messages. From Japan, embrace stakeholder capitalism. And from the president of a trillion-dollar multinational, this too shall pass. The path may be rocky for a while, but democracies will adjust, as they always do. Thanks for joining us. I'm Alec Hogg. Until the next time, cheerio. This coverage of the Global Conversation on Change was brought to you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.